I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide, and welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really going to unpack a fascinating moment looking at the underlying currents and, well, the surprises from a pretty complex day in global affairs.
And I'm Sam Astor, the guest. Yeah, looking forward to synthesizing this quite sprawling set of information we have. We want to go beyond just the headlines and understand what it really means for you, the listener.
We're focusing our deep dive today specifically around the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, October 21st, 2025.
Okay, so setting the scene for that day, the market context, it's really interesting. There's this powerful contradiction happening.
Right. On one hand, the market action looked incredibly positive.
Yeah, exactly. The Dow Jones, it soared up 515.97 points. That's a solid 1.12% jump.
And tech stocks too, right? The NASDAQ?
The NASDAQ was right there with it, up a strong 1.4%. Even over in Europe, this Dino XX 600 climbed 1.0%. So, you know, on the surface, it looks like pure risk-on sentiment.
Mostly driven by that AI buzz, that tech anticipation that just keeps going.
That's the prevailing narrative, definitely. But then you look deeper.
Yeah, that's where the other signals come in. The 10-year Treasury yield still kind of stubbornly high, right? 3.986%.
Uncomfortably high, yeah. And the really big one, the ultimate fear trade indicator, gold. It's just absolutely rocketing.
Incredible numbers, hitting nearly $4,336.40 an ounce. That's up, what, $146.50 in just one day?
A massive move, just huge. Oil, meanwhile, was kind of flat, down a tiny bit to $57.52.
So you've got this surge in gold alongside this, well, this exuberance in stocks. It's cognitive dissonance.
That's exactly the term for it. Financial cognitive dissonance. It tells you that, okay, the daily market is betting big on growth, on AI efficiencies.
But at the same time,
major institutional money, the big players, they are simultaneously hedging like crazy against severe systemic risk. Could be geopolitical, could be inflation getting out of hand again, who knows?
So that's our mission today, right? To dive into what explains this contrast, the excitement around tech versus this alarming fragility in the systems we rely on.
Precisely. And let's start right there with that fragility. We tend to think of cloud infrastructure as, you know, solid rock. But this Amazon Web Services outage, AWS, it really pulled back the curtain.
Showed just how delicate global connectivity really is. And this wasn't just a blip.
No, not at all. This was one of the longest, most impactful AWS outages we've seen. Hit services all across the U.S. and beyond. And the cause, it's almost mundane, but really worrying.
It came down to a faulty update, right? A minor one. To the domain name system, the DNS.
Yeah, the DNS. Basically, the internet's giant phone book translates website names into the numbers computers use. Mm-hmm. A single software tweak, the kind of thing that happens constantly, went wrong.
And it sent out bad information, like a wrong number hitting something called DynamoDB specifically.
Exactly. And DynamoDB isn't some small piece. It's a core database service for AWS, handles huge amounts of traffic. So when that bad DNS data hit it, everything downstream started to cascade.
And given Amazon's market share, they control about a third of the public cloud, right?
A huge chunk. So when AWS sneezes, the whole digital economy catches a cold. Or in this case, maybe pneumonia.
The impact was massive. Started inside Amazon, messing with package sorting, driver routes.
But then, boom, spread outwards. Millions of users affected. Alexa devices just went dead.
Corporate tools like Slackdown, Zoomdown, Venmo, Coinbase, Instacart too.
Yeah, the economic fallout was immediate. Over 4,000 flights delayed. Financial transactions just stopped. News websites couldn't update. Even the Wall Street Journal itself was hit.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it? The fragility comes from that centralization. Critical infrastructure, which definitely includes the cloud now, is so vulnerable to these single points of failure.
Incredible efficiency, sure, but at the cost of resilience, perhaps.
And the costs weren't just abstract numbers. We saw these stories, like a small woodworking company in Maryland.
Rockville, yeah. They lost a whole day of shipping, couldn't log into their fulfillment vendor system because, well, it ran on AWS.
That's real money lost, deadlines missed, customer trust damaged, all from a DNS glitch happening somewhere else entirely.
And that story about the Ponce Bank CEO.
Oh, right. Couldn't charge his EV.
Because the charging network needed AWS for payments. He figured the outage cost his bank somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 just in transaction delays and operational chaos.
These specific examples, they just drive home how deeply embedded the digital layer is in the physical economy now. and how reliant, maybe dangerously reliant, we are on these centralized systems.
And the reporting suggests this is definitely pushing executives to look harder at diversifying their cloud providers.
But the analysts are saying, hold on, the risk isn't just AWS, right?
Exactly. The other big providers, they face similar vulnerabilities. Yeah. The core issue is the concentration itself.
Okay, so from a city kind of brought to its knees by a cloud issue, let's pivot. Let's talk about San Francisco, a city supposedly being resurrected by, well, by another kind of tech.
Yeah, San Francisco. Just a couple of years back, everyone was talking death spiral, pandemic exodus, crime, homelessness, a really bleak picture.
But now the narrative is this huge comeback, and there's data behind it.
There is. Burglaries reportedly down 28%. Homeless encampments smaller. Foot traffic, transit ridership, they're ticking up. And the big one for real estate, rents. Mm-hmm. Up 12% year over year. That's the 13th straight month of growth.
Wow. And the engine driving this, it's pretty clear, isn't it?
Oh, undeniably. It's the artificial intelligence boom, full stop. You've got OpenAI, obviously, but also major players like Databricks. They just took a huge new 150,000 square foot headquarters downtown.
And Salesforce, too. That massive $15 billion five-year investment in their AI incubator hub right there in the city.
It's a huge commitment. The whole vibe has shifted. The city's chief economist, Ted Egan, he basically said the willingness to invest is back.
You can almost picture it. The return of the SF uniform, the button down and the puffer vest.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Founders, young AI hopefuls, some maybe even dropping out of Stanford again.
Mm-hmm.
They're flooding back in, drawn by this AI gravity.
But there's a paradox here, right? A big one.
A huge one. This AI boom, it's incredibly capital intensive, billions flowing in. But it seems surprisingly light on creating lots of new jobs, especially broadly.
So the office vacancy rate, it's still really high.
Still stubbornly high. It's down a bit from the absolute peak last year, which was almost 37%. But it's still sitting at 34.4%. AI firms are taking up space, yeah, about a quarter of the demand, but the jobs they do create are very specialized.
And that's the real friction point. I saw that quote from Mark Benioff, the Salesforce CEO.
Right. He was pretty blunt about it. Said because of AI coding tools boosting productivity so much, Salesforce just wouldn't be hiring any new engineers this year.
So massive investment, expanding footprints, rents booming, but not necessarily a broad job recovery for everyone else.
Exactly. And what does that lead to?
An affordability crisis. Again.
Right back to it. Those rising rents are making the city incredibly expensive for working families, for teachers, for service workers, pushing that inequality problem right back into the spotlight.
Even the mayor, Daniel Lurie, acknowledged it. They still have huge challenges with housing, drug use, cutting red tape for retail.
So it's a boom, yeah, but a very specific kind of boom. One that might actually make the underlying social issues worse, not better.
And the struggle trying to manage costs through policy, it's not just housing. It's absolutely raging in the insurance world, too. Home and auto.
Oh, yeah. A genuine cost crisis there. It's driven by things like, you know, more severe weather, climate change impact, plus inflation hitting repair costs, supply chains.
The numbers are pretty stark. Since January 2020, home insurance rates up an average of 50%.
50%. And auto insurance up 42%. Compare that to the overall inflation rate, the CPI, which is up about 26% in that same period.
So insurance costs are way outstripping general inflation. And since you have to have insurance,
it becomes a massive political football. People are feeling the squeeze big time.
And the political response seems to be, well, pretty heavy-handed regulation, considering price controls.
That's the move in several states. Michigan, for example, proposed a straight 10% cut in auto insurance rates. Just mandated.
Illinois is looking at banning insurers from raising rates because of disasters happening in other states. Like, Illinois shouldn't pay for Florida hurricanes.
That's the argument. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Louisiana gave its regulator power to just strike down premiums they deem excessive and even demand refunds.
But the insurance industry is pushing back hard on this, right? Saying price caps don't work.
Their argument is, look, these caps might feel good politically in the short term, but they wreck the market long term. If you force companies to sell policies for less than the actual cost of the risk, they'll just stop selling policies altogether. They'll pull out of the state.
Which brings us to the unique way insurance is regulated in the U.S.
It's really an outlier. It's been state by state since the 1850s. And crucially, since the 1940s, the McCarran-Ferguson Act basically exempts insurance from a lot of federal antitrust laws.
So each state is its own little kingdom when it comes to insurance rules.
Exactly. Which leads to these really fragmented, sometimes volatile, state markets.
And California is the perfect example of this going wrong, isn't it?
The absolute cautionary tale. They had this effective cap for years, around 6.9% on rate increases, but then the wildfire risk just exploded.
Making it unprofitable for insurers to operate under that cap.
Right. So major insurers started pulling back, reducing coverage, or leaving altogether. The market plunged into crisis.
And the state regulator, Ricardo Lara, he was forced to do what?
He had to approve big double-digit rate hikes, like 17% for State Farm. Not because he wanted to, but because he had to prioritize availability over pure affordability.
Because affordable insurance doesn't mean much if you can't actually buy it anywhere.
Precisely. You can mandate low prices, but you can't mandate that companies offer the product if they're losing money on every policy. It highlights that fundamental tension.
That tension, that friction between local policy and these big global market forces, that's actually a perfect segue, isn't it, into our next area, geopolitical contests and policy friction.
Absolutely. And let's start with China's dominance in rare earth minerals. This is a huge strategic issue.
Dominance is almost an understatement, right? They control something like 90% of the global refined supply.
An astonishing figure, 90%. And these minerals, they're critical. You need them for everything from F-35 fighter jets and missile guidance systems to the magnets in wind turbines and electric vehicles, even your smartphone.
And this wasn't an accident. China built this dominance deliberately over decades.
Decades of strategic state-directed policy, starting way back in the 90s. They did a few key things.
Like consolidating their own domestic producers.
Yep. Turned hundreds of small mines into a few state-backed giants, poured in massive subsidies, and crucially, they went shopping overseas.
Acquiring key foreign technology and assets. The big example everyone points to is MagneQuench, right? GM's magnet business.
The defining moment. Chinese state-linked firms bought MagneQuench in 1995. What did they do immediately? Shut down the U.S. plants and shipped all the critical equipment straight to China.
Instantly creating dependency, and then they use that power to stifle competition.
Exactly. Whenever the U.S. or others tried to restart domestic production, like at the Mountain Pass mine in California,
China would just flood the market, dump cheap rare earths to crash the price.
precisely. Deliberate market manipulation. It bankrupted the Western companies trying to compete, like Molycorp, which ran Mountain Pass. They simply couldn't survive when China could undercut them indefinitely thanks to state support.
And now there's a new move, tightening export controls. This has really spooked the U.S. government.
Yeah, this is a significant escalation. China now requires companies to get permission to export magnets that are made outside China if those magnets use any Chinese rare earth materials in their production, even tiny amounts.
Wow. So even if a company in, say, Germany makes a magnet using 99% non-Chinese materials, if there is that 0.1% of Chinese rare earth in there.
They need Beijing's approval to export it. It's incredibly effective economic leverage, a way to control downstream industries globally.
How's the U.S. responding? President Trump threatened massive tariffs.
100% tariff threat on Chinese goods, which, would have huge ripple effects domestically if actually implemented. In the meantime, there are efforts to fund domestic alternatives, like helping an Australian company build a refinery in Texas.
But it's tough going, still hard to compete with China's scale and pricing.
Immense uncertainty. China has shown they're willing to use price as a weapon to maintain their dominance. It's a really difficult strategic challenge.
And this global tension, this push for critical material independence, we're seeing it filter down directly into U.S. corporate strategy. Look at Cleveland-Cliffs, the steelmaker.
Yeah, their CEO, Lourenco Goncalves, was very direct. He credited the existing 50% steel tariffs with helping them secure new supply deals with major automakers.
Basically arguing that tariffs are changing the game, forcing manufacturing decisions back towards domestic suppliers.
That's his take. He argues tariffs are here to stay and companies need to adjust. And now, Cliffs is doing more than just steel.
They're actually looking into producing rare earths themselves in Michigan and Minnesota.
Exactly. They're actively exploring it. Goncalves explicitly framed it as aligning with the national strategy, ensuring the U.S. has domestic sources for these critical minerals, just like they've helped achieve with steel. It shows how policy, even controversial policy like tariffs, can really shift corporate investment.
Okay, shifting from global supply chains to domestic policy friction, let's talk immigration, specifically that controversial $100,000 H-1B visa fee. There's been a clarification on that.
Right. The government confirmed the fee will only hit new visa applicants who are outside the U.S. when they apply.
So if you're already in the US, say, as an international student on an F1 visa wanting to switch to H1B.
Your potential employer won't have to pay that massive fee. This is crucial because a lot of H1Bs go to people already here.
Why the distinction? Is it a legal thing?
It seems to be entirely about the limits of presidential authority. The administration used its travel ban powers to impose this fee, but legally, that power generally only applies to people trying to enter the country, not those already on U.S. soil.
So it dramatically narrows the scope. I saw a figure, something like 54% of H1Bs last year went to people already in the US.
Roughly, yeah. So a majority are essentially exempt. The fee becomes a very targeted measure.
Aimed primarily at whom, then?
It looks like it's really aimed at those large IT consulting and outsourcing firms that hire huge numbers of workers directly from overseas, especially places like India, bringing them into the U.S. specifically for client projects.
So it hits that specific business model without hitting, say, a US tech company hiring a PhD graduate from a US university.
That seems to be the effect, allowing the policy while staying within those legal bounds.
Meanwhile, elsewhere on the immigration front, there's this unique protest happening in Chicago in response to increased immigration raids.
Yeah, Operation Midway Blitz, as the feds are calling it. Activists are fighting back with, well, whistles. Thousands of plastic whistles being handed out.
And there's a system to it, like signals.
Kind of a local alert system. Short bursts mean ICE agents are just seen in the area. Be aware. But a long, sustained whistle means an arrest or confrontation is happening right now. Come observe.
So it's partly a warning system for migrants and partly a call for citizen witnesses, hoping to deter agents.
That seems to be the dual goal. There was an anecdote about a previous raid where residents surrounded agent vehicles, things escalated, tear gas was used. So the idea is maybe eyes on the situation prevents escalation.
How's DHS responding?
Publicly, pretty dismissive. A spokeswoman basically said their agents are highly trained pros and they're not afraid of loud noises and whistles.
This whole dynamic, local resistance versus federal enforcement, it plays out even more dramatically with the use of the National Guard, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we have conflicting court rulings on that in Portland, Oregon.
The appeals court said President Trump can deploy the National Guard there.
Yes, the Ninth Circuit reversed a lower court. The majority pointed to the really serious violence that had occurred at the ICE facility there. Protesters throwing rocks, mortars, even trying to set the building on fire.
They said that met the legal threshold for federalizing the guard because local authorities couldn't handle it.
That was the majority's reasoning. They said the president has that authority when federal law enforcement is impeded.
But there was a strong dissent.
Very strong. Judge Susan Graber called the ruling absurd. She argued the really bad stuff, the firebombing attempts, happened months ago.
And the current protests are different.
She pointed to the, quote, chicken suits, inflatable frog costumes, or nothing at all, being worn by protesters now, suggesting the threat level just wasn't there anymore to justify bringing in the military.
But in Chicago, the courts ruled differently. They halted guard deployment.
Right, a federal judge there said, look, the federal government has been able to protect its property in Chicago without needing the guard. They hadn't showed it was necessary.
So the courts are looking at the specific facts on the ground in each city, not just giving blanket approval.
Exactly. They seem willing to scrutinize the executive branch's claims of necessity, requiring proof that the situation is current and truly beyond local capacity.
Okay, sticking with the judiciary, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a really interesting Second Amendment case.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It asks whether people who use illegal drugs still have a constitutional right to own a gun.
And unusually, it's the Trump administration arguing for the gun restriction here.
Right. They're defending the existing federal law that bans anyone who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance from possessing firearms.
What triggered this case? A lower court ruling.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in New Orleans, they made a really controversial ruling. They said banning gun possession for drug users is unconstitutional unless the person was actually impaired at the exact moment they were arrested with the gun.
Wow. So casual, unimpaired use wouldn't disqualify you.
According to the Fifth Circuit, no. And they based this on that 2022 Supreme Court decision, Bruin.
Bruin said gun laws today need a historical precedent, right? From the founding era.
Exactly. Bruin requires a historical analog. The Fifth Circuit basically said there wasn't a clear historical tradition of banning nonviolent, non-impaired drug users from having guns.
So, how's the administration arguing against that? What's their historical analog?
They're arguing the current ban is a modest, modern analog to old laws that harshly restricted gun ownership for habitual drunkards. They're saying the founders considered such people dangerous and unreliable, and today's drug users fall into a similar category.
They're worried the Fifth Circuit ruling would gut the law.
They warned it would prevent prosecution in the lion's share of these cases, making the law almost useless.
And it's impossible not to note the political background here. This is the same law Hunter Biden was convicted under before his pardon.
That's correct, the very same statute. So the Supreme Court's decision here will be huge for defining just how strictly that Bruin historical test applies.
Mm-hmm.
Can modern laws be analogs, or do they need to be near-perfect copies of 18th century rules?
Okay, before we dive into the markets, just a quick touch on that. Unusual construction project at the White House.
Yes, the ballroom. President Trump's privately funded $250 million ballroom.
Construction started, parts of the East Wing facade came down, photos leaked, and then Treasury employees next door were told not to share pictures.
That's the report. It seems the administration wants to control the narrative around this massive project. And massive it is.
It's a legacy project for him, right? The scale is enormous.
Huge. Slated for at least 90,000 square feet. Capacity for over 650 seats. Compare that to the current East Room, the big formal space, which only seats about 200.
So this is a vast expansion meant for large gatherings, galas, supporter events,
mm-hmm.
physically reshaping a historic building.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's a striking contrast, isn't it? Thinking back to the AWS outage, how invisible, fragile digital infrastructure can be crippled by a software bug, while here, immense resources are going into this very visible, very physical, monumental structure.
Okay, let's shift gears then. Part three, corporate culture, markets, and legal battles. Let's start with that anxiety in the market about the AI trade.
Yeah, it's palpable. The concentration is just staggering. Those magnificent seven tech AI stocks, they now make up something like 44% of the entire S&P 500's value.
Which has driven amazing returns, obviously, but creates this huge systemic risk if that AI bubble pops.
It could drag the whole market down hard.
Yeah.
So investors are definitely looking for ways to hedge, to find some insurance against that volatility.
Financial advisors are pointing to a few alternatives. What's the first one?
Equal weighted funds. Simple concept. Instead of waiting by market cap where Apple and Nvidia dominate, these funds give every company in the index the same weight.
So big swings in the giant AI stocks have much less impact on your overall portfolio. Smooths things out.
Exactly. Reduces that concentration risk significantly. That's option one. Option two, healthcare stocks.
The traditional defensive play.
Right. People still need healthcare prescriptions, procedures, even in a downturn. Spending is relatively steady. Plus, many offer solid dividends. Johnson & Johnson, for instance, was up 34% this year already.
Okay. Third alternative, looking overseas.
International shares. Big inflows there recently. A record $50 billion into non-U.S. equity funds in the last 3 months. Some markets have just crushed the S&P 500.
Like South Korea's KOSPI, up 60%. Germany's DAX, up 22%.
Yeah, offering diversification and often better valuations than the pricey U.S. tech sector. So that's number three. Number four, subscription software.
Companies with recurring revenue, like Procore, ServiceTitan.
Exactly. Businesses that sell software via subscriptions tend to have very predictable earning streams. That revenue keeps coming in, quarter after quarter, providing a cushion even if the broader economy slows down. Investors like that stability.
And the fifth alternative. This is the one that really shows the anxiety level.
Gold. Physical gold. It's been the hottest alternative. Prices blew past $4,000 an ounce for the first time ever.
Driven by inflation fears, geopolitical worries.
All of it. Gold miners are soaring too. That Vanek Gold Miners ETF up 130%. Some analysts are now calling for $5,000 gold by the end of 2026.
Wow, that's a serious flight to safety. Really underscores the macro anxiety underlying the market rally.
Absolutely. Okay, now shifting from broad market hedges to some specific corporate battles. And one is just bizarre. The NBA investigation involving Steve Ballmer, Kawhi Leonard, and this failed online bank.
This story is wild. It connects high finance fraud, a billionaire sports owner, a superstar player.
It centers on Joe Sandberg, co-founder of this online bank called Aspiration. He just pleaded guilty to wire fraud, admitting he ripped off investors for nearly $250 million.
And Steve Ballmer, the owner of the LA Clippers, was a major investor in Aspiration, put in $50 million.
He did. Now, the NBA is looking very closely at a specific, very strange $48 million endorsement deal between Aspiration Bank and the Clippers star player Kawhi Leonard.
Strange, because Leonard barely had to do anything for the money and wasn't exactly known for being a chatty endorser.
Precisely. An Aspiration executive apparently texted someone saying the deal made no business sense whatsoever. especially given Leonard's injury history and quiet nature.
So the suspicion is, what? That Ballmer used aspiration to funnel extra money to Leonard.
That's what the NBA is investigating. Was this $48 million essentially a side payment, a way for Ballmer, through his investment in aspiration, to give Leonard extra compensation beyond what the NBA salary cap allows?
If true, that would be a major violation of league rules, circumventing the cap.
A huge violation. Ballmer denies it, says aspiration conned him too, but the league is taking it seriously.
It's just this incredible tangle. A failing bank committing fraud uses a weird endorsement deal, potentially as a way for its big investor team owner to cheat the salary cap. It raises huge ethical questions.
About wealth, power, sports ownership, finding loopholes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complex modern mess.
Okay, let's move to a slightly less complex, but still aggressive, legal fight. The battle over frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yes. J.M. Smucker, maker of Uncrustables, which is like a $920 million brand now, is suing Trader Joe's.
Over Trader Joe's version, the crustless peanut butter and strawberry jam sandwiches, Smucker says it's a copycat.
An obvious copycat is the claim. They want Trader Joe's to destroy all their inventory and pay damages.
What's the basis for the lawsuit? The concept of a crustless sandwich isn't new.
It's about the specifics of the design and packaging. Smucker has trademarks on the unique visual elements. The round, sort of pie-like shape. The specific way the edge is crimped. They call it distinct peripheral undulated crimping.
Undulated crimping, okay.
And also the colors used on the packaging. They're claiming trade dress infringement.
This seems like part of a bigger trend, right? National brands fighting store brands.
Definitely. Private label products, store brands like Trader Joe's, they're cheaper for consumers, more profitable for the stores, and they're gaining market share fast. About 20% of total sales now.
So the big national brands feel threatened and they're defending their turf aggressively using IP law.
Exactly. We're seeing it elsewhere too. Lululemon suing Costco over workout apparel they say copies their designs. Mondelez, the snack giant, suing Aldi over similar packaging. It's becoming a major battleground.
Okay, from the grocery aisle to the streaming wars, Disney had a bit of a PR and subscriber headache recently.
Yeah, around the temporary suspension of Jimmy Kimmel Live.
That was after Kimmel made some comments about the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, right? Got very political.
Very political. It blew up. The FCC chairman even hinted at possible regulatory action against stations carrying the show. Mm. Some big station groups like Nexstar and Sinclair actually dropped the show for a bit.
And this had a measurable impact on Disney's streaming numbers.
It did, according to internal data reported. Cancellations for Disney Plus apparently doubled compared to their recent average, jumped from 4% to 8% in September. Hulu cancellations also doubled, from 5% to 10%.
And it became public, too, celebrities canceling.
Yeah, people like Cynthia Nixon, Howard Stern, publicly announced they were ditching their subscriptions in protest.
How did Disney resolve it?
They brought Kimmel back pretty quickly. His return episode actually grew huge ratings, like 6 million viewers, way above his average. And the stations picked the show back up.
So did the cancellations hurt them long term?
It's interesting. While those cancellation rates spiked significantly during the controversy, Disney's overall signups for both Disney Plus and Hulu were still up in September compared to August.
So a burst of anger and churn from some, but the underlying demand for the platforms remains strong.
It suggests that, yeah, the political flare-up caused real measurable anger, but maybe didn't fundamentally damage the core business appeal for the majority of subscribers.
Okay, one last piece in this markets and corporate section.
Yeah.
Geopolitical risk hitting high finance again, this time with Argentina.
Right. A group of major U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan, Goldman, Bank of America, Citigroup, they're supposed to be putting together a $20 billion loan for Argentina.
This is part of that bigger $40 billion package the Trump administration is trying to arrange for President Milei's government to stabilize things.
That's the plan. But the banks are hesitating. It's a very risky loan to a country with a terrible track record of default.
What's the sticking point? They need collateral, a guarantee.
Exactly. They're extremely wary. They want solid collateral from Argentina, or ideally some kind of guarantee or backstop from the U.S. government itself.
And since the U.S. Treasury is coordinating the whole package, the banks are basically waiting for guidance from Washington.
Pretty much. They need clarity on what Argentina can offer or what the U.S. is willing to put on the line to make this happen. Until then, the deal is stuck.
It just shows, even when the White House pushes for something, banks will still balk if the financial risk looks too high without clear guarantees. Political will isn't enough.
Risk assessment wins out. Okay, let's move into our next section, global and domestic political flashpoints. Starting in the Middle East, with that Gaza ceasefire, it sounds incredibly fragile.
Yeah, the October 10th deal, brokered by the U.S., it's barely holding on. There have been repeated clashes. An attack by Hamas militants killed two Israeli soldiers recently,
which prompted a flurry of U.S. diplomatic activity. Senior officials, like Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner, rushed back to Israel to try and shore things up. Vice President Vance is heading there, too.
And the U.S. isn't just talking, right? They're putting troops on the ground.
About 200 U.S. troops, yeah.
Yeah.
Not on a combat role, but setting up a civil-military coordination center. Your job is to monitor the ceasefire, keep tabs on aid flows.
Using drones, yeah. Working with NGOs.
Exactly. Using surveillance drones, coordinating with partner organizations. It shows a really serious, hands-on U.S. commitment to trying to make this truce stick and prevent a full-scale relapse into conflict.
And President Trump added his own characteristic warning.
He did. Stated very clearly that if Hamas doesn't straighten it out, then this little situation will be taken care of very quickly.
A clear threat of potential military action if the diplomatic track fails. High stakes.
Very high stakes. Meanwhile, on the other major conflict front, Ukraine and Russia, that truce effort seems completely stalled.
This was after that tense meeting between Trump and President Zelensky.
Right after. Both Kyiv and Moscow basically signaled they are miles apart on any kind of deal.
The reporting suggested Trump was very blunt with Zelensky, focused on ending the war now, maybe less on specific territory.
Yeah, the priority was clearly stopping the fighting immediately. Less emphasis on, say, guaranteeing the return of all of the Donbas region to Ukraine. Trump also apparently held back on promising immediate shipment of those long-range Tomahawk missiles Zelensky wants.
And Zelensky's position hasn't changed, still refusing to concede territory.
Absolutely resolute. He argues Putin's demand for a full withdrawal from Donbas is unacceptable. He believes any territory handed over would just become a staging ground for Russia to regroup and reinvade later.
He thinks Putin wants the whole country eventually.
He said Putin wants total occupation of Ukraine, and any concession just buys Russia time. So this fundamental disagreement means the war grinds on, heading into its fifth year, despite this push for a deal.
And we're seeing another kind of escalation this time in Latin America with the U.S. approach to the drug war. It sounds like the lines are blurring there.
They really are. President Trump took aim directly at Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, called him an illegal drug leader.
Wow. And threatened to cut U.S. aid and impose tariffs unless Colombia shuts down killing fields.
Yeah, really dialing up the pressure, turning a key security partner into an adversary almost. It's part of a broader shift.
The U.S. campaign in the Caribbean seems much more aggressive now, using military force against drug boats.
Dramatically so. Reports confirm at least 7 suspected drug smuggling vessels, mostly small boats, have been attacked and destroyed by U.S. forces. At least 32 people killed.
And the justification is labeling them narco-terrorists.
That's the administration's term. But using lethal military force against what are often just low-level smugglers, without trial or clear evidence presented publicly, it's raising serious legal and ethical alarms in Congress.
Lawmakers are questioning the legal basis. Trump notified Congress they're in a non-international armed conflict with cartels.
He did. But figures like Senator Rand Paul are asking, wait, how are we targeting and killing these people? What's the evidence? It seems less about pure drug interdiction and more about putting extreme pressure on governments the U.S. doesn't like Venezuela's Maduro or now Colombia's Petro, trying to make them miserable enough to go away, as one source put it.
Blurring that line between counter-narcotics and regime change.
Very much so. Okay, let's bring it back home. A domestic political flashpoint. The New York City mayoral race. It looks like a fascinating mess.
A three-way race that could actually hand the city over to a democratic socialist.
That's the dynamic. You've got Zoran Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist, as the frontrunner, then former Governor Andrew Cuomo running as an independent, and Curtis Sliwa, the Republican founder of the Guardian Angels.
And Mamdani's leading primarily because Cuomo and Sliwa are splitting the opposition vote.
Exactly. Polling shows Sliwa is acting as a pure spoiler. His votes seem to come almost entirely at Cuomo's expense. If Sliwa dropped out, Mamdani's big 14-point lead reportedly shrinks down to just 4 points. Basically the toss-up.
So there's huge pressure on Sliwa to quit. Cuomo's basically saying a vote for SLEWA helps Mamdani.
Immense pressure. Cuomo's making that argument very publicly.
Yeah.
It's all about whether that anti-Mamdani vote can consolidate behind one candidate.
And what's Mamdani's platform? It sounds pretty radical for NYC.
It is. Raising income and corporate taxes significantly, the combined city-state corporate rate could go over 21%. Freezing rents on a million apartments, demanding free bus rides, which would cost around $700 million a year. Setting up city-owned grocery stores.
And shifting police funding.
Yeah, moving money from the NYPD to a new Department of Community Safety.
Critics must be warning about driving taxpayers out, especially the wealthy.
That's the big fear. Raising taxes on the top 1%, who already pay about 40% of the city's income taxes, could push high earners and businesses to leave, potentially triggering a fiscal crisis like the city saw in the 1970s. So the whole race hinges on this spoiler dynamic.
Okay, and just one last quick return to that White House ballroom project.
Right. Just underscore the scale again. 90,000 square feet, 650 plus seats.
Yeah.
Dwarfing the existing East Room. It's a physical testament to political ambition, literally reshaping the White House grounds.
Quite a contrast to the invisible, fragile digital world we started with. Okay, let's move into our final section, lifestyle, culture, and the human element. And this first one is, well, unexpected, water menus in fancy restaurants.
Yeah, this is peak fine dining culture meets commerce. Michelin-starred places are treating water like wine now. You get a separate menu.
Detailing what? The water source. Minerality.
Exactly. Provenance, acidity, mineral content. The server, sometimes a dedicated water sommelier, will recommend pairings. Maybe a smooth, low-mineral water from the East Coast for your delicate fish, or a high-mineral, maybe slightly bitter water to cut through a rich steak.
Is this actually a business? Do people pay extra for this?
Oh, yeah. Martin Rees, he's the water sommelier at Gwen in L.A., says water sales can bring in up to $100,000 a year for the restaurant.
Wow. And they take it seriously. No ice, no lemon?
Absolutely not. That would apparently dull the delicate flavor profile.
Mm.
It's all about the total dissolved solids, or TDS.
Yes, that's the key.
That's the main metric. High TDS means more minerals, often tastes more bitter or acidic, pairs better with fatty food. Low TDS is smoother, drier, better with lighter stuff.
Any really extreme examples?
There's a place in Virginia selling water called Berg Water for $95 a bottle. It's sourced from melted 15,000-year-old icebergs. Supposedly tastes like ancient packed snow and air.
$95 for iceberg water.
Okay. And the biggest menu is apparently in Spain, 150 different waters from 33 countries. Sounds kind of absurd, maybe, but clearly there's a market for these exclusive curated experiences.
All right, from curated water to curated living arrangements, we're seeing shifts in how older Americans are living, driven by costs and maybe loneliness.
Yeah, the rising cost of housing, which we talked about in San Francisco, is hitting seniors too, plus health challenges and just wanting companionship. It's leading many to seek shared living situations.
The numbers are up significantly. People over 50 living with unrelated housemates.
More than doubled in two decades. It was nearly a million people in 2023. They're rejecting that traditional model of just aging alone in a big house.
So what kind of alternatives are emerging? Co-housing?
Co-housing is one model. These are intentional communities, often self-governing, designed for social interaction, like the Mountain View co-housing community in Silicon Valley. Then you have builders responding.
Like Lennar's next-gen homes, multi-generational homes under one roof.
Exactly. They build homes with completely separate living units, separate entrances, kitchens, bedrooms attached to the main house, for aging parents, adult children, whatever they need.
And nonprofits are getting involved in matchmaking.
Yeah, home sharing organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Like HomeShare Oregon. They vet homeowners, often older people with extra space, and potential housemates. They help match them up, mediate agreements.
It's mutually beneficial. Income for the owner, cheaper rent for the sharer.
And companionship, oversight, maybe help with chores or errands. There was a story about a 72-year-old homeowner whose housemate was crucial support after she had a car accident. It goes beyond just the money.
Interesting. Okay, changing gears completely now. Air travel. Southwest Airlines is finally ditching its famous open seating policy.
They are. Starting in January, assigned seats are coming to Southwest. But the system sounds complicated, described as needing a graduate-level course to figure it out.
I know it's called the Wilma method.
Wilma, yeah. See, it's for window, middle, then aisle. That's the boarding order within each row, starting from the back of the plane.
So back rows board first. Within a row, window seats go first, then middle, then aisle.
That's the core idea. But then it gets layered on top of nine different boarding groups.
Nine groups? How are those decided? It sounds like it creates a real hierarchy.
Oh, it absolutely does. It clearly prioritizes frequent flyers and people willing to pay more. Groups 1 through 8 depend on your ticket type, your status in their loyalty program, etc.
And there's a group even before group 1.
There's a 9th group called priority boarding. You pay extra for it, and the price can change dynamically, sometimes over $90 one way. They board first, along with military and people with disabilities.
So what does this mean for the average traveler? The big worry is carry-on space.
That's the huge uncertainty. You might manage to get a decent seat assignment, like 12C, an aisle seat near the front, but you could still end up in boarding group 7.
And by the time group 7 boards,
the overhead bins could easily be completely full, especially near the front. So it creates a lot of anxiety about whether you'll have to gate check your bag.
Southwest must be banking on this system improving turnaround times, despite the complexity.
That seems to be the gamble. Predictability, plus the revenue from selling priority boarding, might outweigh the confusion and potential frustration for some passengers.
Okay, a quick detour into college sports before we wrap up. The 2025 football season sounds completely wild.
Historically bonkers was the phrase used, just totally upside down. Traditional power struggling, longtime doormats, suddenly becoming contenders.
Like Indiana, ranked number 2. Georgia Tech, number 7.
Unheard of, basically. Indiana, undefeated. Georgia Tech, the highest-ranked team from the ACC. But the biggest shocker might be Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt, ranked number 10. That's their highest since...
Since 1947. They beat LSU. They're being called a football power. Vanderbilt.
How did this happen? Transfers.
Primarily, yeah. It shows the power of the transfer portal and, interestingly, legal action. Their star quarterback, Diego Pavia, he actually sued the NCAA over eligibility rules when he transferred from New Mexico State.
And he won and brought coaches and players with him.
He won his case, which set a precedent allowing a waiver for others in his situation. So, yeah, he arrived with key staff and players and boom, instant turnaround. It highlights how player movement and legal challenges are reshaping college sports rapidly.
Okay, let's bring this all together now. A final thought, connecting back to that AWS outage we started with, but looking at the human side of automation in fulfillment centers.
Right. There's this really vivid account of someone touring an Amazon distribution center, a modern one, a version 9 design from around 2015. Huge place, 1 million square feet.
And the most striking part is the dark zone.
Yeah, the largest part of the facility is kept dark. And in there, thousands of these little orange robots, like robotic lawnmowers, are just swarming around constantly.
What are they doing? Moving shelves.
Moving these huge 8-foot-tall shelves packed with inventory. Everything stored randomly, but the central computer system knows exactly where every single item is. The robots just bring the right shelf to the human workers.
And the humans, what's their role in this system? There are still thousands of them, right?
About 3,100 employees in this facility working long 10-hour shifts. They work at the boundary, the DMZ, where the light zone meets the dark zone.
And their job is very prescribed.
Described as zero judgment. They just follow instructions on a screen, pictures telling them exactly. Take item from bin 2 on this shelf, place it on the right side of shelf level 5 on that outgoing shelf. It's all gamified, too, for speed and competition.
The person writing about the tour found it unsettling.
Deeply unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
A colleague on the tour apparently remarked that it wasn't the dark zone full of robots that looked dystopian. It was the humans in the light zone doing this incredibly repetitive, algorithm-dictated work, mindlessly moving items based on commands from some distant server, maybe running on AWS.
The same AWS that can go down because of a DNS glitch.
Exactly. It connects back. And the conclusion is pretty stark.
The prediction is these centers will eventually go entirely dark. No humans needed inside.
Just a skeleton crew, maybe 100 technicians, to fix the robots. Which raises the obvious, massive question. What happens to the other 3,000 people currently employed there whose jobs have been broken down into these tiny, easily automatable tasks?
It's a powerful image of where this efficiency drive leads. Solving logistics problems, but creating huge labor displacement challenges.
Yes. So reflecting on the whole day, it's just packed with these contradictions, isn't it?
Definitely. This incredible speed of change, technological, geopolitical.
Yeah.
You have the AWS failure showing the fragility, the AI boom promising transformation, China flexing its supply chain muscles.
And contrasting that sharply with this deep, deep institutional friction. Resistance to change in policy, like insurance regulation or immigration gridlock. The slow grind of legal battles, the inertia in labor markets, maybe.
So the key takeaway for you, the listener, has to be about looking deeper, right? Thinking critically about these systems.
Absolutely. It's not enough just to see the market numbers. You need to grasp the underlying risks being accepted, like the reliance on centralized cloud infrastructure. You need to see how policy choices or failures in areas like insurance or housing create real crises on the ground, even while technology races ahead elsewhere.
Understanding how global supply chains, like rare earths, are intertwined with geopolitics and national security, how market forces and political interventions constantly push against each other.
That systemic view is crucial.
Okay, before we wrap up, let's leave everyone with one final thought to chew on. Something that really ties together some of these threads: sports, celebrity, big money, ethical gray areas.
Let's go back to that NBA investigation. The Clippers, Steve Ballmer, Kawhi Leonard, and that bankrupt bank aspiration.
Think about the sheer complexity there. A bank that was already defrauding its investors. A billionaire team owner who was one of those investors. A superstar player. And this very weird $48 million endorsement deal that, according to insiders, made no business sense.
The core question the NBA is wrestling with: was this elaborate setup involving a failing financial institution, essentially a scheme to cheat the league's salary cap rules, a way for immense personal wealth to buy a competitive advantage outside the established system?
So what does this whole tangled mess tell us about the intersection of extreme wealth, celebrity culture, sports business, and ethics in the 21st century? How willing are powerful players to operate in these complex financial and legal gray zones to get an edge? It seems the drive is relentless.
It certainly raises profound questions. Something to think about. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep digging deeper.
Thank you for joining us for the Deep Dive.